In the literary world, few novels have captured the raw intersection of drug trade, love, and violence, quite like Don Winslow's Savages. This 2010 thriller became an instant cult classic, praised by critics for its unflinching portrayal of the modern drug war and its stylistic innovation. Opening with perhaps the shortest first chapter in literary history, a simple "fuck you," Winslow's novel immediately establishes its uncompromising tone. The book gained mainstream recognition when Oliver Stone adapted it into a film starring Blake Lively, Taylor Kitsch, and Aaron Johnson, though many readers insist the book's unique narrative style and brutal honesty couldn't be fully captured on screen. Stephen King called it the best of the best, while Entertainment Weekly praised it as a revelation, a taut, relentless thriller that's also a dazzling work of literature. At the heart of Savages is an unconventional love triangle between three distinct personalities whose lives become entangled in Laguna Beach's high-end marijuana trade. Ben is the compassionate, Buddhist-leaning entrepreneur with a social conscience, a botany and business double major from Berkeley who creates the world's most potent cannabis strains. His business partner, Chan, represents the opposite end of the spectrum, a former Navy SEAL who served in Afghanistan and Iraq, bringing home both PTSD and precious white widow cannabis seeds. Chan's default response to the world is "fuck you," or, as Ophelia, O, calls it, "baditude." O herself completes this triangle, a privileged but neglected Orange County girl whose name was shortened from Ophelia, given to her by her mother Pac, passive-aggressive queen of the universe. With her blue-streaked blonde hair, colorful tattoos, and nose stud, O deliberately rebels against her shallow South Orange County upbringing. She sleeps with both men and loves them equally, seeing Ben as warm wood and Chan as cold metal. One makes love, the other fucks. Their relationship defies conventional boundaries. O divides her time between them without jealousy or possessiveness. Ben and Chan accept this arrangement, their friendship transcending potential rivalry. This unconventional family unit forms the emotional core of the novel, three damaged individuals who find in each other what the world has failed to provide them. Ben gives O purpose and tenderness, Chan gives her protection and intensity, while she gives them both unconditional acceptance. As O puts it, her philosophy is simple: more love is better than less love. The trio's business thrives on Ben's botanical genius. He's created a genetic masterpiece, an ultra-white widow strain so potent it requires a strong constitution to handle more than one hit. Their operation has expanded from 1 to 30 grow houses, all producing premium marijuana with a cult-like following of customers who call themselves the Church of the Latter-day Saints. Ben creates various indica sativa blends, all incredibly powerful and customized for individual customers. Their business model is distinctly non-hierarchical. Dealers set their own targets, budgets, and schedules with profit participation and even health benefits through Ben's legitimate Third World Crafts Corporation. The trio's peaceful existence shatters when the Baja Cartel sends them a horrifying video showing 9 severed heads lined up on a warehouse floor. The message is clear. Ben and Chan must stop selling their hydro retail and instead sell it wholesale to the cartel at the cartel's price. The video serves as a graphic illustration of the consequences of refusing. Winslow expertly portrays the Baja Cartel as a ruthless corporate entity, vertically integrating all aspects of the drug trade while expanding horizontally into human trafficking and kidnapping. As O succinctly puts it, they're Walmart. The cartel has already taken over heroin, cocaine, and methamphetamine distribution, and now they're targeting the marijuana market to eliminate competition from small growers like Ben and Chani's. The novel reveals that the Baja Cartel is run not by a man, but by Elena Sanchez Lauder, Elena La Reina, a 54-year-old woman who never wanted to lead, but took over as the last Lauder standing after drug wars decimated her family. Elena took control to save her son Hernan, who lacked the necessary ruthlessness and intelligence to lead. Despite her wealth, power, and still attractive appearance, Elena is profoundly lonely, with a son unhappily married, a daughter wed to a dull factory manager, and her unpredictable youngest daughter, Magdalena, studying archaeology at UC Irvine. Elena's enforcer, Miguel Arroyo, known as Lado or Helado, Spanish for stone cold, embodies the cartel's brutality. A former Baja State cop who witnessed and committed numerous brutal acts, Lado now leads the cartel's Southern California operations. His eyes have turned to stone after seeing and doing terrible things, including beheadings. Lado maintains a double life, a family man with a wife and three children in Mission Viejo, while running a landscaping business as a front for his cartel activities. When Ben and Sean refuse the cartel's demands, the situation escalates dramatically. O is abducted while shopping, and the boys receive a video showing her with a chainsaw at her feet. The cartel's terms change. Ben and Sean must grow and sell product at set prices for 3 years, plus provide certain services. The deal is non-negotiable. O's captivity becomes a psychological journey. Initially terrified, she gradually adapts to her circumstances, developing what resembles Stockholm syndrome with her guard Esteban, a young Mexican man whose girlfriend Lourdes is pregnant. They watch The Bachelorette together on Hulu, and O gives him relationship advice. To cope with her situation, O creates a new persona as a tragic heroine rather than tragically hip heroine girlfriend, mentally researching famous beheaded women from history and movies. Meanwhile, Ben and Chan face an impossible choice: cooperate with the cartel and hope O survives 3 years, find and rescue O, or pay the $20 million ransom. They decide to try locating her while simultaneously working to raise the money. Ben can liquidate investments to get $15 million, but they're still $5 million short. The abduction transforms both men. Ben, the pacifist, is forced to confront violence directly. Chan, already familiar with brutality from his military service, returns to his combat mindset. When ordered to kill a man in San Diego to prove their compliance, Chan doesn't hesitate, swimming underwater to a boat, entering the cabin, and shooting a sleeping man in the head. Though he spares the man's female companion, thinking, "I'm not a savage," this act marks the beginning of their descent into the very savagery they oppose. The novel's central theme emerges as Ben and Chan are forced to become what they despise to save O. Ben, who once proudly called himself a Baddist, a bad Buddhist who embraces the core principle of doing no harm, finds himself committing increasingly violent acts. His transformation begins with small compromises, first accepting the necessity of violence, then actively participating in it. When forced by Lado to execute Alex, a cartel lawyer falsely accused of betrayal, Ben pulls the trigger while thinking of O, marking his first direct act of murder. The moment serves as a pivotal point where his philosophical principles collide with brutal reality. Chan and Ben's descent accelerates as they begin robbing the cartel's cash shipments to raise the ransom money. Their first heist, wearing Leno and Letterman masks, nets $765,000, a success that comes with an unexpected rush of adrenaline and power. Their second, wearing Clooney and Pitt masks, brings in $820,000. Each successful robbery not only emboldens them, but also normalizes their criminal behavior. The masks themselves become symbolic, famous faces hiding the loss of their own identities as they sink deeper into the violent world they're fighting against. The moral transformation reaches its apex in their most ambitious plan, using IEDs and sniper tactics to ambush a cartel convoy in the desert. The preparation for this attack shows how far they've come, as they meticulously plan mass murder with the same attention to detail Ben once applied to his legitimate business. As Ben waits to trigger the explosives, he experiences a moment of profound self-awareness. This won't be self-defense, but premeditated murder, and his hand trembles with the weight of this recognition. though he briefly hesitates, recalling his former belief that murder is the suicide of the soul, he ultimately flips the switch, killing multiple cartel members. When Chan is shot during the attack, Ben crosses another moral line by executing the wounded survivors, an act of cold pragmatism that would have been unthinkable to his former self. The aftermath of the desert ambush powerfully illustrates how circumstances can transform even the most peaceful individuals. Ben, once dedicated to nonviolence and sustainable business practices, has become capable of cold-blooded execution. As he drives away from the scene, blood on his hands, both literally and figuratively, he conducts an internal Socratic dialogue about taking human life. He struggles to justify his actions through various philosophical frameworks, utilitarian ethics, necessity, survival, but ultimately acknowledges he doesn't recognize himself anymore. His realization that it's all fun and games until someone loses an eye becomes a haunting commentary on the loss of his moral identity and the price of survival in a world of violence. Throughout the novel, Winslow delivers a scathing critique of American culture and the arbitrary distinctions between legal and illegal drugs. Ben sees the war on drugs not as a genuine effort to reduce drug use, but as a war on drugs likely to be produced and/or consumed by people of color. White drugs like alcohol, prescription opioids, and pharmaceuticals create legitimate billionaires and respected corporations. Black, brown, and yellow drugs, marijuana from Mexico, heroin from Afghanistan, cocaine from Colombia, land you in federal prison with mandatory minimum sentences. The novel repeatedly questions who the real savages are in this scenario. Is it the cartel members who behead their enemies and dissolve bodies in acid? The American government that wages endless wars while profiting from the opium fields of Afghanistan? The privileged suburban consumers who remain willfully ignorant about the violence that supplies their weekend pleasures? Or is it something more fundamental, something inherent in human nature itself? The story suggests that perhaps civilization itself is built on savagery, merely hidden behind a veneer of law and order. Chan, shaped by his military experience in Afghanistan and Iraq, argues humans are violent by nature, nonviolent by training, citing scientific evidence about chimpanzees who share 97% of our DNA, yet routinely engage in territorial warfare and kill each other without social conditioning. He sees humans as essentially chimpanzees with guns, destined to destroy ourselves through increasingly sophisticated methods of violence. This pessimistic view stands in stark contrast with Ben's initial belief in humanity's capacity for peace, cooperation, and ethical behavior, a belief that gets severely tested throughout the narrative. The novel also examines the artificial nature of borders, both geographical and moral. Chan, from his military experience, sees national borders as merely states of mind, arbitrary lines drawn on maps that mean nothing in the real world of power and violence. Meanwhile, Ben grapples with crossing moral borders from which there's no return, watching himself transform from a peaceful businessman into someone capable of extreme violence. Southern California itself becomes a powerful metaphor for this tension. A civilization precariously built between ocean and desert despite chronic water shortages, where people proclaimed individual freedom, built temples to our fantasies, reinvented ourselves daily, defied aging and death. This artificial paradise, maintained through complex systems of resource theft and denial, mirrors the larger themes of civilization's dependence on hidden violence. The story ultimately suggests that the distinction between civilization and savagery may be largely illusory, that our sophisticated modern society, with its laws and moral codes, may simply be a more elaborate version of the same territorial violence we see in our closest animal relatives. As the story accelerates toward its conclusion, the violence escalates exponentially, transforming from calculated strikes into unbridled chaos. The attack on the cartel convoy, executed with military precision, draws intense media scrutiny. Conservative talk show hosts whip themselves into a nationalistic frenzy about La Reconquista and the Mexican invasion, while liberal commentators debate drug policy and border politics. The incident becomes a lightning rod for America's complex relationship with its southern neighbor. The DEA investigation reveals telltale signs of professional military involvement, precise shot groupings, tactical formations, and specialized equipment usage. These details point to trained operators rather than common criminals. Meanwhile, a local gun shop owner recognizes Chan from recent purchases and connects him to the attack, promptly informing Lozado. This betrayal sets in motion an irreversible chain of events. Elena's reaction to the betrayal is swift and ruthless. She orders Lozado to execute O while forcing Ben and Chan to watch, a punishment designed to inflict maximum psychological trauma before death. Backed into a corner, Ben and Chan make an audacious countermove, kidnapping Elena's daughter Magdalena from her luxury apartment near UC Irvine. The college student's peaceful academic life contrasts sharply with the violence about to engulf her. They arrange a hostage exchange, fully aware they're walking into a trap, but seeing no alternative in their desperate endgame. The exchange location, a desolate desert crossroads, serves as the perfect symbolic setting for this final confrontation between civilization and savagery. Ancient indigenous trails, modern drug routes, and the arbitrary lines of national borders all intersect here. As the captives approach each other under the harsh desert sun, Elena gives what appears to be a standard execution signal. However, her men unexpectedly turn their weapons on Lozado instead of the Americans. Through Lozado's wife Dolores, Elena has discovered his long history of betrayal, skimming profits, unauthorized side deals, and multiple murders that served his interests rather than the cartels. The night erupts in apocalyptic violence. Lozado melts under a hail of bullets before being ceremoniously beheaded, a cartel signature. Elena, still thirsting for revenge, orders her remaining men to eliminate Ben, Chan, and O, triggering a massive firefight that transforms the desert crossing into a killing field. O, showing unexpected resolve, grabs Lozado's dropped pistol and joins the battle alongside Ben and Chan. When silence finally descends, Elena sits wounded against her bullet-riddled Land Rover, surrounded by dead sicarios. She looks at O with a mixture of respect and resignation, saying, "You see what men are?" A final commentary on the masculine violence that has shaped both their lives. O's response is equally loaded as she hefts Chan's fallen rifle, declares, "I'm not your fucking daughter," and pulls the trigger, rejecting both Elena's worldview and any possibility of mercy. The novel's conclusion unfolds as a haunting symphony of tragedy and transcendent beauty. In the aftermath of a brutal firefight with cartel members, Ben lies mortally wounded, blood seeping through his shirt. Rather than abandon him or attempt a futile escape, O and Chan make their final choice, a suicide pact that transforms their inevitable end into an act of ultimate devotion. With steady hands that have dealt both death and comfort, Chan prepares three precisely measured morphine injections. As the drugs begin to take hold, they create their own sanctuary in these last precious moments. Ben, always the poet among them, paints a vivid picture of Indonesia's paradise, describing pristine golden beaches stretching endlessly under azure skies, emerald jungles teeming with life, exotic birds painting the air with flashes of scarlet and gold, and gentle-souled people living in harmony with the ancient rhythms of the earth. "It sounds like heaven," O whispers, her voice carrying both longing and acceptance. The cold, beginning to creep into her limbs, is banished by Chan's protective warmth as he positions himself behind her, his arm reaching across to grasp Ben's hand, completing their circle. The novel's final passage achieves a remarkable serenity. O drifts in a peaceful surrender, her consciousness floating on the rhythmic sound of waves breaking against smooth pebbles, punctuated by the gradually slowing heartbeats of her two loves. Wrapped in their shared warmth, her mind crafts a beautiful vision of their afterlife, a pristine beach where they exist in perfect freedom, catching fish, picking fruit, and making love like beautiful savages. This deeply poignant ending suggests that even in a world corrupted by violence, greed, and betrayal, love remains humanity's one true salvation, even if its purest expression can only be achieved in death. Don Winslow's Savages masterfully challenges readers to examine the razor-thin line between civilization and savagery. The novel presents a world of stark contradictions, drug cartels operating with corporate efficiency while legitimate corporations employ cartel-like brutality, governments denouncing violence while perpetuating endless wars, and ordinary individuals forced to embrace their darkest nature to protect what they hold dear. Through these parallels, Winslow suggests that perhaps the label of savage applies to us all, lurking beneath our carefully constructed civilized facades. The story's raw power lies in its unflinching examination of human nature and the often brutal realities of the modern world, forcing readers to confront uncomfortable truths about both individual morality and societal structures. The tragic end of O, Chan, and Ben serves as a mirror, reflecting back at us the savage heart beating within our civilized chest. The character transformations in Savages represent one of the novel's most compelling aspects. Each protagonist undergoes a profound metamorphosis, with innocence corrupted by necessity and violence. Ben's journey from peaceful badass to cold-blooded killer serves as the most dramatic example. His initial refusal to participate in what he calls the war on drugs gradually crumbles as circumstances force him to embrace the very violence he once abhorred. When we first meet Ben, he's described as a man with a social conscience, his conscientiousness. He spends months in developing countries, saving some group of people from something, digging wells in Sudan, providing mosquito nets in Zambia, monitoring army violence in Myanmar. His marijuana business operates on principles of fairness and mutual benefit, with profit sharing and health care for employees. Yet by the novel's end, he's capable of executing wounded men in cold blood and kidnapping an innocent college student. O's transformation is equally profound, though less obvious. Initially portrayed as a shallow, privileged girl whose life revolves around shopping, drugs, and sex, she develops unexpected resilience during her captivity. She creates coping mechanisms, builds relationships with her captors, and discovers a desire for purpose beyond her former empty existence. In her fake emails to her mother, she expresses a newfound desire to create a meaningful life, possibly doing humanitarian work overseas. When she finally confronts Elena in the desert showdown, O has become capable of killing, a far cry from the carefree girl we met at the beginning. Even Chan, who begins the novel already hardened by war, undergoes transformation. His cynical worldview that humans are essentially chimpanzees with guns is challenged by his love for Ben and O. Though he's always been willing to kill to protect what's his, the lengths to which he goes for his friends reveal a capacity for selfless love that contradicts his nihilistic philosophy. In the final scene, rather than saving himself, he chooses to die alongside his friends, an act of loyalty and love that transcends his survivalist instincts. Winslow uses the Southern California setting to powerful effect, portraying it as both paradise and purgatory. Laguna Beach represents the pinnacle of the American dream, beautiful beaches, perfect weather, wealth, and freedom. Yet beneath this idyllic surface lurks violence, corruption, and moral bankruptcy. The novel repeatedly references how celebrities like John Wayne, Bob Hope, and Bing Crosby bought up chunks of California real estate and sold the California dream. This commodification of paradise parallels the drug trade itself. Both sell escapism and pleasure at a hidden cost. The marijuana business thrives in this environment precisely because it offers temporary transcendence from the emptiness of materialistic existence. In one particularly poignant passage, Winslow meditates on Southern California civilization. "We built a culture between ocean and desert despite water problems. We proclaimed individual freedom, built temples to our fantasies, reinvented ourselves daily, defied aging and death. We made gods of wealth and health, created a religion of narcissism, worshiping only ourselves. In the end, it wasn't enough." This critique extends to American foreign policy as well. Chan's military experience in Afghanistan and Iraq serves as a constant reminder of America's global violence, while the domestic war on drugs represents another form of that same militaristic approach. When Chan brings back White Widow seeds from Afghanistan, it symbolically connects America's foreign wars with its domestic drug problems, both forms of violence that ultimately come home to roost. The novel suggests that the American dream itself has become corrupted by greed, violence, and hypocrisy. The very freedom that allows Ben and Chan to build their marijuana business also enables the cartels to operate. The wealth that provides O with her privileged lifestyle is built on systems of exploitation similar to those that power the drug trade. In this moral landscape, the distinction between savage and civilized becomes increasingly blurred. Through these complex characters and their tragic journey, Savages delivers a powerful meditation on violence, love, and the thin veneer of civilization that separates us from our most primitive instincts. The novel's unforgettable ending, three lovers choosing death together rather than life apart, offers a strange kind of hope that even in a savage world, love remains the one true redemption.